Thank you very much, Ryan Burrow. Steve Bertrand here. It is 12:10 on the Wintrust Business Lunch on this Friday afternoon, 720 WGN. Thanks very much for tuning in. Tom Gimbel from the LaSalle Network will be along a little bit later. You know, it's getting close to holiday party season. Why not? So he says it's a good chance to network, to meet some people, and to, to put some extra food in your pockets for the way home. So we'll talk to Tom about that. Also, a Northwestern University professor in the second half hour talks about, you know, the Republicans and Donald Trump, they say they are going to repeal Obamacare. Can they really do that? It's going to take a lot, so we will kick that around. But we start on Fridays, as we do every Friday, with Andrea Haines, the editor of Blue Sky Innovation. You can read that in the Tribune. Andrea, welcome back to the Business Lunch.
Thanks, Steve.
Oh, there's so much to talk about, you know, and we've been election sort of central today, and I just think you can't really help that. But a couple of stories. I want to talk about Facebook and social media and all of that, but we've got to start with what's going on in Grubhub, because you guys had written a story even earlier about the dangers of speaking out politically for innovation leaders and things like that. And then one of the co-founders of Grubhub just stepped in it this week.
He did. So Matt Maloney, who is one of the founders of Grubhub and now its CEO, wrote a letter to employees after the election, 1,400 employees, and basically, you know, perhaps trying to reassure people that their workplace was a safe place, regardless of race and gender and some of those issues that people are concerned about. But the letter, you know, really went a little bit far in suggesting that employees with certain views might not be welcome at Grubhub, which caused a firestorm.
He said if you support Donald Trump, you should find another job.
So he didn't exactly say that. And that's exactly where the parsing,
right,
you know, kind of comes in, and the backpedaling and the explaining. And I think what you could argue is that as CEO of a public company, you should do that parsing prior to sending the document versus after.
So maybe
everyone has read it.
What he meant to say was, if you are a racist, misogynist, Islamophobe like we think Donald Trump is, there's no room for you here.
Exactly. I think he called out specific behaviors that people would probably agree are not allowable in workplaces. So on that grounds, perhaps it's literally true that those kind of behaviors cannot be, you know, done in the workplace. But I think to equate those with Trump voters and potentially making employees who may have supported Trump or customers who may have supported Trump feel like they're just not welcome, you know, becomes a problem for me.
That's a big problem. I can go back to 1992. I remember this distinctly. The day after Bill, this is a little related, not directly. The day after Bill Clinton was elected, beat George Herbert Walker Bush. And I was doing news for Roy Leonard at the time, the great late Roy Leonard. And a caller called, and he goes, yeah, he goes, I'm a business owner. This is probably 9 o'clock in the morning. I'm driving to work, and this is the day after the election. I'm going to lay off a third of my workforce. And we're like, what? He goes, well, Clinton elected, it's going to doom the economy. I'm going to get ahead of it, and I'm going to lay these people off. And, you know, the Clinton years turned out to be pretty good when it came to economics. So
yeah,
you just never know what will come during the Trump years, and we can hope for the best.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's a lesson here, I guess, about trying to make people feel good, safe, and welcome, but realizing how things may be perceived and that there's another side. And that's kind of, I think, something else that's fascinating about Grubhub being part of this is, like, it's sort of coverage map probably about mirrors the divide in this country, right? It's a very urban service. There probably are a lot of liberal-leaning customers of Grubhub, but it maybe reinforces that feeling that you're in a bubble and everyone thinks
right,
like you, and this is the way you get out there with some words that kind of slaps you back to realize that not everyone does think like you, and there's now hashtag boycott Grubhub to prove it.
Well, in a way, maybe he was trying to make people feel welcome by excluding others.
Perhaps.
Which is exactly what Donald Trump is accused of doing.
Perhaps. I'm sure he's going to have plenty of opportunities to continue to explain himself because there are questions about it.
All right, let's go.
With that said, I think he's, you know, I don't think there's too much danger of maybe it becoming more than that at this point, but it definitely creates an interesting debate.
Let's go to Macedonia. I love this story. Talking about, you know, Facebook and other social media outlets, they hold huge sway, and they did in the election. People aren't getting their news from a newspaper or a radio newscast. They're getting it on Facebook. A lot of the stories that they're reading on Facebook are fake. They're lies. And the question is, should Facebook and others be responsible for weeding those out. So tell me about the guys in Macedonia.
Yeah, so more than 44% of Americans are apparently getting their news from Facebook, and sneaking into those feeds are some of these fake articles. So this particular story mentioned teenagers in Macedonia that are literally writing made-up fake stories that were basically anti-Hillary Clinton, and those are being picked up as news.
They're being shared hundreds of thousands of times.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
They're making money by the shares. So by them making up the stories, the more outrageous perhaps, the more shares, and they're making money sitting there in Macedonia.
Yeah, it's the decision you make every day when you're in the news, right? It's like you often have to tamp things down to get to the truth. The truth isn't always the most inflammatory thing. In this case, you have people who are obviously not journalists, who are not so much worried about chasing the truth, but are almost have the opposite incentive to just make it as crazy sounding and as shareable and as wacky as out there as possible.
And the more shares, the more money Facebook makes.
Yeah. So, well, Facebook is another interesting point. Mark Zuckerberg, you know, was saying yesterday that he didn't think that fake news that appears on Facebook was impacting voters. But as people point out, that's a tough argument to make when your very business at Facebook is centered on selling to advertisers the idea that you do influence readers, so you kind of can't have that both ways.
So, but in a way, if he tamps down on these fake stories that are getting a lot of play, he's hurting his own bottom line too.
Yeah, but they've got to figure that out.
Right.
You know, they have a big responsibility with the kind of eyeballs and audience that they have, and I think they're going to need to figure out ways to meet those responsibilities.
Okay, we've got a minute left. Let's have lunch together. A bowl of Soylent.
Oh, the Soylents. Yes, if you're curious about Soylent, we did a taste test. We talked to a bunch of Chicagoans that are using it. It's a liquid meal replacement that you can grab.
Is it like Ensure? You see TV as Ensure?
It is. Okay. But, you know, if you're a hot, hip tech person, you can't drink Ensure. So, yeah, you have to have Soylent. And, like, it's, you know, it's sort of a taste-free, a little bit gritty, but there are people that want to grab something really fast.
Thick,
and they
it's
feel
kind
like
of it's thick.
Kind of thick.
Have you tried it?
People can't see this, but I'm kind of squirming. I did try like a teaspoon of it. I couldn't get my mind around it. I just, you know, there's a texture problem there for me, and I don't think I could get past that.
So, but the idea is it's hot among the entrepreneurial
class. It's hot among the entrepreneurial scene. People that are so busy and they have to prove how busy they are and be super competitive and prove they can work all day and not stop for lunch. Yes, they're grabbing a bottle of Soylent.
Good for them. I hope it makes them happy. Andrea Haines, good to see you again. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Steve. You too.
Listening to the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand here on this Friday afternoon. Tom Gimbel, the man behind the LaSalle Network, is in the studio as well. Tom, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Always good to be with you, Steve. Thanks for having me on.
All right, I said earlier you're going to talk about holiday parties, and I want to do that. But let's just, you know, there's been a lot of copy and people talking about, you know, elections in the workplace,
totally.
Too, right?
Yep.
What do you do there?
It's very tentative. I mean, I believe we have a great workplace culture. In fact, we were just at the Tribune Awards last night for top workplaces in Chicago.
Oh, nice. Congratulations.
Number 5 this year, so we're pretty excited. Self-promotion there.
5 is very good, and you've got room to improve.
We've got room to improve.
Can't beat that.
But I can still feel there's a little bit of a sense of a fog in the office and a sense of you know, what was a joke a week ago? You could make a joke about either candidate, and everybody laughed. And now you make a joke, and it's just not as funny. And I think that's real. And whether you agree or think people are overly emotional or it's not a big deal, people feel what they feel. And you gotta. I'm sending out. I meant to do it before I came over here, actually. But a company email because I was out of town the first part of the week, and just to say to everybody, it's okay.
Yeah, and it's going to be okay.
There's only one thing we can directly control, and that's our jobs and what we do and how we treat each other, and we do those things.
I think everyone's reaction is enhanced or amplified by the fact that no one expected it, right? So the pro-Clinton people weren't factoring in the possibility, I don't think, that Donald Trump could win, and I don't know that the Trump people were either, so it's especially hot, the reactions, I think.
Yeah, I think when you go in and you assume, right? Well, what does our teachers teach us in high school, right? Don't assume.
When
it
are we
makes
learn
a you
that?
Know
Is
something out of you and
that?
Me, right? and the population thought, and it's good lessons for everybody. And I said to a friend who was kind of distraught, I said, I missed it. Were you out there knocking on doors and canvassing? Because typing something into Facebook isn't participating.
Someone said the protesters on Michigan Avenue should have been canvassing in Kenosha.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's real. And if anything else, hopefully the country takes notice and the representatives and senators take notice.
We'll see. All right. Enough of that. Let's talk holiday parties.
Yep.
And from what I've heard, you always should get there early, drink as much as you can while the bar's still open.
I think this year it's going to happen beyond belief. I'm worried about my bar tab at the holiday party.
But the idea is, and one of your suggestions, and it's a good one, I think, is to actually go to the holiday party with your spouse.
Yeah, if the company invites spouses, right, some do, some don't. If they do, bring your spouse. If they don't, you should go alone. View it as a positive. The company is saying, whether you think they should spend the money or not, the company is saying, we want to do this.
Right, right.
So go enjoy yourself. Have fun.
And when you do that, I mean, I'm the sort of guy who walks into a room and like, I got no one to talk to here.
Yeah.
What am I going to do?
It's absolutely perfect for you, Steve. Go meet people. The whole concept is, if you can meet somebody in a casual situation, maybe it'll make your job better the day after the holiday party. View it as an opportunity to expand your network and make friends. It's not a bad thing.
And obviously behavior is important because your wife is going to have to go back to work the next day.
Yes.
Is that really much of an issue?
If you're the spouse, I think it's more important than if you're the employee.
Yeah.
Right? Because you don't want to be viewed on something. But if you're the employee, and is this really the first time you've ever socialized over an alcoholic beverage with your coworkers? I mean, and I said to somebody the other day, if that's the case, that's the problem.
Right.
It shouldn't be the only time. This isn't 1967. It shouldn't be the only time you socialize with your coworkers is the Christmas party.
But I think it is. Right, don't you think?
I don't think so. I think now with happy hours and casual Fridays and people going out and there's brewery, there's a city winery, all these different things around here, right? People go out all the time with each other.
Okay, so one of the other things you say is bring your card so you can network.
Yep.
And when that suggestion is a good one. I never have mine because I think, well, it's so electronic now, which is not replaceable.
So it's not just your company holiday parties. There's industry holiday parties.
But my question is, if it's the company, if your wife, it's your wife or husband's company party, and you go with your business cards, isn't there? You don't want to take over someone else's party.
You don't want to be Ned Ryerson from Groundhog Day. Is that what you're saying?
Right, exactly.
I totally agree with you. But if you're having a good conversation with somebody and what their kids do or their parents do or there's some correlation, oh, that's really interesting. Do you have a card? Have it. Doesn't mean you have to volunteer it. If somebody asks for it, be ready.
Nothing wrong with being prepared.
No.
Tom Gimbel, thanks for coming by today.
Always good to see you.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. We'll check the news headlines with Ryan, and then after that, Elise Glink in the marketing of the candidates ahead on WGN. Thanks very much, Ryan Burrow. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch. It's a Friday afternoon on 720 WGN. Thanks very much for tuning in. Hope you'll follow me on Twitter at Steve Bertrand and on Facebook, Steve Bertrand or Steve Bertrand Travel. I got a few spots where you can find me. You can find Elise Glink and even more. She joins us on a phone line now. Elise is the co-host of the Monday Morning Podcast, Monday Morning Marketing at WGN Plus and bestmoneymoves.com as well. Welcome back to the Business Lunch, Elise.
Hey, thanks, Steve. It's been a crazy week, right?
It's just been such a crazy week, and it's one of those where, I think people are still trying to figure out how to react to it. I mean, I am anyway.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, my whole team, who are a bunch of under 30-year-olds, they've been walking around sort of shell-shocked because they never imagined that who they voted for wouldn't win, although I've had that experience any number
right.
of times.
I got to tell you, I don't want to get into how I voted, but, let's just say I had a lot more losers than winners this time, I think.
Well, the real question is, what do you learn from something like this? And I think, Democrats and Republicans and everybody else on the political side, they have all kinds of lessons that I have, nothing to share about any of that. But I do think that, from a marketing point of view, the selling of a Donald Trump presidency, in the election cycle, and then, of course, going forward, how you sell that to people who are diametrically opposed to you and people who are in support of you, how you sell that is going to be very, very important.
Well, we'll see how this all shakes out when people write the books about why this happened or how it happened. But it seems as if you could make the case that one of the turning points for Donald Trump was when Steve Bannon and Kellyanne Conway joined the campaign, replaced Paul Manafort. Now, Bannon has been mostly behind the scenes, so it's not clear what influences he's had or how he's influenced. Kellyanne Conway sort of became the face of the campaign.
She did, and, you know, it's really interesting how she managed the brand and what they were tapping into. So her background is, of course, as a pollster, and she said all the way through, we're seeing numbers that nobody else is reporting. So, you know, the traditional media went, oh, yeah, well,
right. That's
what
totally
are your numbers?
Like, fine, whatever.
But she managed the brand to the numbers that she was seeing, and what she really did, and I'm of this firm belief, is that he was actually able to stay on message, even in that last week where he would talk to himself on stage saying, stay on message, script, you know, stay on script, Donald, stay on script. But, you know, getting him to be normal and likable enough to be electable as president, I think, was the thing that she did really well, because his brand has changed. And when you're, you know, a marketing person and you look at brands and how brands shift, and we've talked on the show quite a bit about Coca-Cola, for example, a new Coke, an old Coke, and going back and forth, and how confusing that can be for people. Well, we saw that happening in real time in this election cycle, where there was Donald Trump, who is, you know, the you're hired, you're fired guy, you know, the reality show Donald Trump, the real estate developer Donald Trump. Then we saw the election guy Donald Trump, the crazy Twitter guy Donald Trump, the locker room Donald Trump. We've seen a lot of different Donald Trumps, and the way Kellyanne Conway managed the brand perception of that all the way through is the lesson to take away from this.
All right, so speaking of lessons, then what can someone who's running a small business learn from the way the Trump campaign ran? I mean, it seems to me to have been a wholly unorthodox approach. Are there lessons that people can pick up?
Well, I think the first lesson is authenticity matters. So it matters in the end that it's an authenticity that people like, right?
That helps, yes.
It really helps. But I don't think that anybody can say that Donald Trump isn't who we saw. I think we saw him. We saw his warts and all, better or worse. And people felt like that was an honest, authentic self. What we heard a lot about Clinton is that she didn't seem to be being authentic. So in this world today, authenticity matters, and people have to want that authenticity that you're presenting. But they can tell if you're being authentic or not.
Okay, so let me jump into that a little bit. Mm-hmm. So you're saying we saw the real estate developer, we saw the candidate, we saw the, you know, all these different Donald Trumps, but there was some truthiness to all of it? I mean, there was authenticity to all of that?
I think people thought that they were seeing who he actually is, better or worse, warts and all. They, a lot of people voted for that. A lot of people voted against it, but it was there on display. I don't think that we'll see a side to Donald Trump that somebody won't say, well, we saw that in the election in, let's say, early September, right?
Right.
I think we've seen all these different pieces of him.
And so the other thing that he did well when he came up with Keep America Great, and those hats, it sounded pretty simplistic and jingoistic, but maybe that's exactly what we needed to hear.
I think simple still counts. So, you know, Bill Clinton did this. He was one of the first people. He said it's the economy, stupid, right? It went up in a it became the motto of his campaign. It's something simple, that a turn of phrase that people can hang their hats on. And if you look at some of the great brands, even if you go back to Frosted Flakes and Tony the Tiger saying it's great, right? It's something that you can grab onto and pack away in your brain and remember it as you're going forward. And I think that just speaks to how complicated the world is right now. And so simple kind of gets through in a way that it doesn't. So if you're a company owner and you're trying to figure out what the clear and concise messaging should be, I think you have to dig deep to find out what is that simple truth that you want people to take away from your brand, from your product, from your service.
All right, tell me, it seems as if it's easier to be against than to be for. And I don't mean that in a positive negative, but when you're coming up with a slogan or whatever, you know, he was running against the status quo. Hillary Clinton was trying to come up with a slogan to preserve the status quo, stronger together, which just didn't resonate. Is it easier from one side or the other?
I think it depends on the product, and it depends on the time in which you're launching that. So new can be very effective. It can also work against you. And I think that the key thing is to be flexible. So if I had to go back and look and see, what we saw was Trump trying different things, and he can read a room better than anybody. It's what live television people are really, really good at. But he also, I think, was able to come back and start to see that if he could stay on message and repeat that message, rinse and repeat, as I like to say, over and over again, right. Communicate the strong message of Make America Great Again over and over again, somebody's going to believe that. And whether, I think now we're all in a place where we have to believe going forward, but if you're a business owner and you're trying to communicate, I think the message for you to take away from this is, you can't just say your message once and hope people remember it. You've got to back that up over and over and over again with multiple touch points in multiple places so that your potential customers are hearing what you want them to hear over and over again in as positive a light as possible.
So if a would-be customer sees the message coming into your place of business, it should be the same message that they're seeing from you on Facebook or on Twitter or in the newspapers?
Correct. I mean, it has to fit in with the place that it's going. But I'll give you this example from when I first started writing books, and I had a really, it's for Random House, and I wrote my book, 100 Questions Every First-Time Homebuyer Should Ask. And my publisher at the time, who's now out in Colorado, said to me, well, what's the message of the book? And the message is, if you haven't ever bought a house before, the game is, you need to learn the game. So here it is. And if you haven't bought a house in the last 5 years, it's really different now.
Right.
So you still need the book. And she said, well, our research shows that consumers need to hear a message a minimum of 7 times before they act. So she had me repeat that message over and over again about being a first-time buyer or treating yourself like a first-time buyer every single time I went out to promote that book. And that was my most successful book, and there were 3 versions of it, 3 editions of it. But it turned out she was right, and I would see somebody at, let's say, a book signing, and they would say, oh, I saw the article about you in the New York Times, and I saw your column in the Tribune, and I heard you on TV, and I heard you on radio, and then I got the sign that you were speaking. And there they were at the 5th or 6th or 7th place. That was the point of purchase for them. And I think, when you hear a very consistent message from a company over and over and over again, and it's backed up by what feels to you as being an authentic experience, then you're going to engage.
We're going to build a wall, and who's going to pay for it, Elise?
I hear that Mexico is paying for it.
There you go.
See what happens.
Great to talk to you again. Have a great weekend.
Thanks so much, Steve. You too.
It's the Business Lunch on 720. Listening to the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, President-elect Trump has been in Washington, New York today. There's a lot of talk about repealing Obamacare. It's something that touches all of us. A lot of people have complained about it. A lot of people benefit from it. Northwestern University Assistant Professor Megan McHugh is an expert on the Affordable Care Act, and she joins us now. Megan, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, you bet. So the first question I have is, can you repeal Obamacare? I mean, it seems as if it's so big and so ingrained that it's not the sort of thing that you can just wave away.
Well, President-elect Trump ran on a very clear platform to repeal Obamacare. And he also promised to repeal it immediately, in fact, in his first day in office. Repealing it outright would be a little bit challenging because it would face a filibuster in the Senate. Even though Republicans control the House and the Senate, it would be a little tough to repeal it. However, there are other things that President-elect Trump and the congressional Republicans could do to dismantle it.
Well, I guess
regulation.
Right. Well, I want to get to that, but I guess that the kind of my point is, isn't it so big right now that if it just were to be repealed with nothing there to replace it, that I would think that that's sort of a big void.
Well, it would. If Obamacare was repealed outright, 22 million people could potentially lose their health insurance coverage. It's probably not going to happen overnight, but we would see some major changes in our healthcare system if it was, in fact, repealed outright.
And, yeah, the other problem is, and there's those 22 million, I mean, people are complaining about the premiums, but the fact is, all of those people, millions now have health insurance. People with pre-existing conditions are covered now in a way that they might not be. So I guess the Republicans are going to have to figure out a way to maybe try to keep the good and get rid of the bad.
That's right. And this is a really complicated thing to think through. There are many parts of the law that some Republicans and a majority of the public actually like. You know, you mentioned guaranteed issue, that insurers cannot discriminate based on pre-existing conditions. They also like that there's no annual or lifetime limits on insurance coverage. But it's really not that easy to slice and dice up the Affordable Care Act to only keep the parts that they like. There are a lot of unintended consequences that could come from, you know, just taking parts of the Affordable Care Act. And the stability of the insurance market is one thing to really consider. So Republicans are really in a bind.
Well, I would think so, because, you know, we forget that the fact, one of the reasons we have Obamacare is because what came first wasn't so good either.
That's right. The healthcare system was deeply flawed before the passage of the Affordable Care Act. Healthcare costs were rising rapidly. We had approximately 50 million people who were uninsured, and there was very little attention being paid to the quality of care that was being delivered.
So what do you think is going to happen?
I think that the Republicans will probably have to make good on their promise to repeal Obamacare. I don't know that we will see a complete repeal of the entire law, but I think that we will see probably a slow dismantling of the law over the next several years.
And that's when you talked about how they could do it through maybe executive order or some restrictions on certain parts of it to sort of winnow it down that way?
That's right, either through regulation or through the budget process.
It's going to be fun to watch, and for an expert in the Affordable Health Care Act, you're going to be busy.
I will, but it'll be fun watching this play out.
Megan McHugh is an assistant professor at Northwestern University. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Steve.
You bet. You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN.